Attention, please. Places for top of show. Places for top of show. Hello, and welcome to Twins Talk Theater. We are Cindy.
And Stacy.
And we're talking about theater, backstage life, and all the excitement that the audience doesn't get to see.
Enjoy the show.
Welcome to this week's podcast. With us today is Cara, who I met about a year and a half ago at the Opera America conference in Montreal. I don't even remember what session we were in, but I was looking for a place to sit at a table, and Lindsay and her were at a table by yourselves, I think. And I was like, oh, good, there's an empty seat here. I'll come sit here. And we started chatting, and Cara was introduced to me as a director, and I said, hey, we're looking for a director for next season. So we exchanged business cards, and I got her hired at TCO, and that's how it all started. So, Cara, welcome to our podcast. Some things that, well, I guess to get started, that you're our first director that we've talked to. So I'm really interested to know how you came into directing, because I'm pretty sure you didn't start as a director. You were a performer first, I believe.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of a long and circuitous story, but it's like, I always was putting on shows since I was a little kid. Like my parents rented this house 2 summers in a row that had a red curtain instead of a door in their bedroom when I was 4 and 5. And so my brother and I were like, okay, we have to put on shows because there's a red velvet curtain.
So naturally. Wow, that is terrible for privacy. Yeah. Bet your parents didn't think about that one.
And then like from there, I don't know, I always was putting stuff on. Like in elementary school, I would just like, my third grade teacher had a stack of plays, and I would just pick them out, and then I would direct and star in them, and I would like make sets, and then I would make my whole class watch them. And then I would also like, I would direct plays, and I would choreograph dances. And then we had a seance club and a playwriting club. And so that was recess, like 3rd through 5th grade. Then as like, wow. But I do remember there was very early on, there was an issue between choosing between directing and acting, because I was in 3rd grade, I was putting up The Milkmaid and Her Pail, and I wanted to be the star and direct, and the other kids got mad at me. And so I didn't star in it, and I chose to direct it. But I feel like this choice would come up again and again. So it started early, and then, you know, by middle school, I was going to theater camp. I was dancing. I started dancing when I was 5. And then by high school, my high school had like a super serious drama program. And we did like Tom Stoppard plays, and we wrote plays and had improv classes and huge musicals. And in high school, I started producing stuff. So I started like a dance club and would like produce dance concerts and do everything, like be this, you know, run tech and do the programs. And so that started really early. And then I went to college at UC Berkeley, and I actually started as a film major. I got really interested in film and wanted to be a film director, and I started as a film major. But Berkeley was super nerdy, and their film program had classes on like Disney as a fascist empire, or like the history of film class would be like U.S. foreign policy as depicted in South American and Cuban films. And there was no production, and I started to realize really at that point, like the thing I loved so much about theater was collaboration and working with people. So I actually applied, but at the same time, when I was a film major, I was still taking dance classes every day and acting classes. And I applied to transfer to UCLA. They had like a junior level transfer program for a production, like a film directing degree. And I decided if I didn't get in, I would be an actor. And if I did, I was meant to be a film director. So I didn't get in. And then, so then I switched my major, and I was like a dance and theater double major. And like the dance program at UC Berkeley was modern dance. So it was all like Martha Graham and Merce Cunningham. And I took like the whole choreography sequence and did a lot of choreography. And then also they had like a directing sequence. Their drama program was very much like, I don't know, it was also super nerdy. It was like your acting classes were your electives, and they had like 20th century theory of performance and like a study of white face minstrelsy, things like that. So,
Wow. I think we had acting 1, acting 2, and advanced acting.
You know, it's good. I like took all the stagecraft classes and costume design. And then I spent the summer after my junior year at Williamstown Theater Festival as an apprentice. And at that point, like the apprentice program there, you work in everything. So it was crewing shows. I was a dresser. Viola Davis was in the show that I was in. Like, it was crazy. And then that's also where I started directing again. I did this Sylvia Plath radio play that was like part of it. I just like produced it and put it on at midnight. But John Guare came and he loved it. And that was like the most exciting thing ever.
Wow, nice.
And then I finished at Berkeley and I did like a acting program at the American Conservatory Theater for a summer. And then I moved to New York to be an actor. And I was like a typical New York, like auditioning. I eventually got sort of an agent and studying, going to class all the time. But there was always like the element of self-producing. I started a little theater company, and like between me and my friends, we were always putting on shows and like sharing the producing parts of it. But I started getting auditions for musicals, and I wasn't really a singer, but I kept getting auditions for like Hairspray and Mamma Mia. That was the time period. And I started studying singing really seriously. And then eventually like got led into the operatic repertoire. So I started singing opera before I had ever seen it. And then it became like a serious hobby. Like I was singing it like 5 hours a day. And then my acting teacher at the time, Michael Howard, pulled me aside and was like, I know you're struggling, whether to be a singer or an actor. And, you know, you're a good actor, but this singing thing, it's got a hold of you and you've got to go for it. So then I decided to go back to school and I did a second undergrad degree, or like 3 years of a bachelor's in music at SUNY Fredonia. So I left New York from 2007 to 2010 and went back to school for opera singing. So when I got into school...
So did you do any singing lessons before that? Because opera is not usually something someone just kind of steps into.
I would say, like, I had been singing for about 5 years. I mean, I sang as a little kid. Like, I loved musicals, and I memorized Les Mis, and I would climb a tree and, like, sing through all of Les Mis.
Okay, that's about normal.
And Miss Saigon, which I realize now, Miss Saigon was probably not an appropriate show for, like, an 8-year-old to be singing about the heat being on in Saigon.
You didn't know any better. It was just hot there, right? They all just, you know, the sun was out.
Yeah. So anyway, I was singing. Once I started getting auditions for Broadway shows, I started taking singing lessons. And that I actually, like around, I don't know, 2004, I left New York for the summer to go train for a triathlon. And so I went and stayed with my parents in Boston. And I ended up studying with someone who taught at Boston Conservatory and taught opera. And he handed me a Puccini aria, O Mio Babbo, you know, caro, and was like, sing this. And I said, you're crazy. I don't know anything about opera. No way. But then I could sing it. And then it was like, oh my God, what is this music? It's crazy. I love it. But I was terrified of it. And so then that sort of led me down a long path. So I would say like 7 years of full on, like trying to be an opera singer. But at Fredonia, I had a terrible experience. Like, I just hated being in music school. It was so different than being a theater major, because I feel like musicians are math and science, whereas like theater people have different brains. And I was not a math and science person. And very soon I realized it was just so much time alone in a practice room, and it didn't feel collaborative, and I just missed making stuff. So I talked my way into the theater classes, and they had a BFA program. But I took their whole directing sequence. I did like a directing special project, and I reworkshopped that Sylvia Plath radio play. But this time it was a dance theater opera with like sections of Suor Angelica and Pagliacci. And like they would speak in Sylvia Plath and they would like bust out with arias. And also,
how interesting.
So I think because I was having such a terrible time as a singer, I really like my love of directing started up again. But while I was there at school, the summer before my final year there, I got hired by Opera America to do these videos for the NEA Opera Honors, which was like an award show. So they were lifetime achievement videos. And so my friend Greg Emmata and I would travel all summer interviewing super famous people like Marilyn Horne and Placido Domingo about opera. And so I started really learning about the industry. And then when I moved back, this is such a long story, I'm sorry.
No, it's great.
Okay. So I moved back after Fredonia in 2010, and I had done another summer of the NEA Opera Honors videos for Opera America. and they wanted to give me a job. So I started by selling advertising in their magazine, just part-time. And then they had an opening in development. So I started there full-time in development, but I was still like doing the NEA Opera Honor stuff. I produced the whole award show for them in 2011, which was insane. And then finally they had an opening on artistic services. So then I switched over and worked in artistic services. And there I did like a lot of producing. And that was at the time when the National Opera Center was being built. So I got to work on the Opera America Songbook, which was a commission of 47 songs by 47 composers that was recorded over a summer. So that's when I really started to get into contemporary opera. And then I started working on the New Works Forums. And so for me, it was like this whole world of contemporary opera opened up, and getting to meet all the composers and librettists who are part of that world was really fascinating. But it also, as I was working there, I got a real crash course on the industry, and it sort of solidified, like, I don't want to be a singer. Like, I want to be more part, like, more up top. I want to be like a con. I took this class with Martina Arroyo in the spring of 2011, and I was working on Mimi. And I just remember like dreading every time I had to get up and sing. And what I really like to do is sit and give other people feedback. And so that was like, again, the key. But, you know, so anyway, I finally like worked up the courage to leave Opera America after reducing down to part time and started freelancing. And I self-produced this show called Aftermath, which was inspired by Donna Elvira. Like, I'm obsessed with this archetype of Donna Elvira and the woman, the really smart woman who can't help but fall for the absolutely wrong man and then can't get over him. So it had like sections of Don Giovanni, but then it also had like every soprano would sing Un Bel Di and then get tackled down in the middle of it. And people, yeah, he's not coming. Just give it up. So that was, gosh, when was that? That was 2013. And I sort of did it to see like, do I want to do this full time? Like, is this what feels best? Because I had, as much as I loved working in Opera America, I didn't like being an administrator. Like, I wanted to be in the rehearsal room. And when there was opportunities to produce concerts and actually be in rehearsals, and sometimes I got to like direct libretto readings and things with them, those were when I felt really alive. So anyway, so that was when I really went full in. And it's been, gosh, it's only been since 2014 some people have been paying me to do it, but that's been sort of the long path of me towards directing. But I think it's like always I've this urge to tell stories. It's never, I've never not had it.
Since you started in dance, how do you feel, like, do you bring a lot of dance into your works now?
I think when I started, I kind of had left it for so long. I really, when I first moved to New York in the early mid 2000s, I was still dancing. I was doing like modern dance pieces. And then it was a really long time and I didn't dance at all. And I felt like I didn't have that. And then at Chautauqua, two summers ago, Ned Canty was coming to direct his production of The Mikado. And I was his AD and they needed me to be like the archival choreographer and study the video and then teach everyone the choreography for the show. And it was a lot, but it actually kind of re-engaged that muscle. And now I do bring a lot of dance. I think the spatial relationships is there just intuitively, but actual dance, like the Merry Widow I'm doing, I'm the choreographer as well as the director. So it is nice to sort of be able to use all that training, because it was about 20 years of dancing and just working in that world.
Yeah, not just dancing, but movement and flow and the way that, you know, you, there's so many ways to walk across the stage. It's not just walking across the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
The question that I had for you was, what, this was kind of a later question, but it came up now. So you kind of started producing your own films and videos and doing like Time Achievement Award videos. How do you incorporate those two? Because I know you've done at least two shows, Hydrogen Jukebox at Chautauqua and then Glory Denied at Tri-Cities Opera. How do you, it's very rare, I think, to have a director who also comes up with all the projections and kind of creates all the projections and everything itself. How do you feel combining those two? Like, do you start looking at it as a director and then look at it as a projection artist, or do they kind of go hand in hand with you? Like, how do you put the two together?
I feel like they go hand in hand. Like with Hydrogen Jukebox, I knew I had a year to prepare. And so one of the things as I was listening, and Hydrogen Jukebox is such an episodic show, and like each song, right, the whole world. And so the first question is, what do you want the projections to do? For that particular show, I really wanted it to be like an extension of the world, like world building. So, you know, they're talking about the Patna Banaras Express. Let's have trains in India, and let's have those colors of India versus, I don't know, the other ones that are just, okay, if this is about the universe, let's have stars and things like that. But I actually had so much time that I have friends who are amazing cinematographers. So I spent a day with my friend Kat, and we went and filmed at Rockefeller Center at Christmas to get that footage. We filmed, like, we spent a whole day shooting for 10 hours, and I literally had a shot list of the stuff that I wanted. That I shot with my friend another day in New Orleans, and we did the same thing. We shot trains and wires and electric towers and things. So it was really listening to it and thinking of, like, what are sort of the leitmotifs of images that I want to see, and getting that content. And then I, because I couldn't take my friends everywhere, I got more equipment and started shooting stuff. And then I created this like insane library of footage. So I got all this raw footage, and then I took it all I learned, and then I took an editing class.
You're so like, well, now I gotta have to put it together. Yeah, somehow,
like, so, to learn how to like edit the footage, because I wanted to be able to go in and like color correct it, or, you know, put it in the correct aspect ratio. Because I knew, like, I mean, my designer, the production designer, Michael Baumgarten, he wasn't like he had 100 hours to put into it, but I did. So, so I spent like a good like 6 weeks editing every day and created a library of footage, and then I sent that to him on Dropbox with 14 pages of notes. And it would be like, number one, here's my ideas. And it would be like 10 minutes of clips for this 5 minutes off. And then we worked together. Like, and he, of course, had some new ideas too. But like, then we worked together to really turn the clips into cues. And that was like a month long process of emailing back and forth. And he would send me, it was really fun because he'd be like, what do you think about this? And then I'd be like, I don't know, blah, blah, not quite right. What if you change this and this and this? And then he would send it back to me. So it was very collaborative and fun. But we knew we had so little time to tech it. We had like a day and a half to light and do the productions, build all the cues. So we had to have it all done. And we actually made Steve Osgood sit in a room with us and play through the entire show on the piano so that we could test the timing of the projections.
That's which, so awesome.
Yeah, he was game for him, but he was sad that he couldn't
right. see them. So you should put a little video up next to him so that he could have watched what was going on.
Yeah, and then with Glory Denied, it was a different sort of process, because with working with Pollock, Lopez Waterman, who was the designer on that, we created the cues together. Like, he would come over, and I certainly still had a huge library of footage, and then we would also go online and look for things, look for like the POW bracelets and sort of source it. And we sat together and built the cues sitting next to each other, which was really fun. And he had sort of a different feel, and also the knowledge to do multiple projectors and have, it was more of a cinematic and more integrated into the set, since he was also the set designer. So that was a different kind of experience. But yeah, I love that it's part of the staging. I love going into staging, knowing what it is, because I try to make it interactive. I try to make it have a relationship to the staging. And so if I know it's a really still moment, I don't want the projections to pull focus in a way. If I know it's something where I want the projections to support the action, then it can be faster. It can be more leading the movement, as opposed to letting the performer lead the projections and lead the world, if that makes sense.
So do you show the singers what the projections are beginning, or at like some point in the process before you even get to tech?
Yeah, I actually show, I bring my computer, and a lot of times I show it during rehearsal. Like, there was a number two in Hydrogen Jukebox, who was the enemy year after year. It was it started with a grave, and then two graves, and then five graves, and then it turns into like an aerial shot of of Arlington National. And at the same time, there was like a scene that was happening that was implying that these soldiers were dying and someone was getting the bad news. And so it was very much integrated with what was happening behind them. So I try to give them as much information as possible of what is happening, because they'll never get to see it.
Right. They can't stop during the show and turn around and look at it.
Yeah.
So.
And even like there was an animation that my husband did, a 6-minute animation for Moloch. And yes. It was really like interactive in that way.
I wish I could have seen your Moloch, because you were talking about it like.
I can send it to you.
Last November. Good. I'm pretty excited about it.
I love working with a designer because even though I feel like I might be a little bit more hands-on than most directors with projections, I do feel like they take me out of my comfort zone, and we get to really, because of the discussion that happens, it's like we get to collaborate and build something much better than I ever could do on my own. I'm actually doing, for Afterlife, I'm designing the projections, and I just learned how to program them on QLab, and it's lonely. I wish I had a partner. There's no one. Like,
can someone just come sit next to me so I feel like I have a partner in this?
Yeah, it's like I called my friend Greg, who's a projection designer, and I made him like teach me QLab. And
that's a tough one. I've just kind of picked it up by pressing buttons, being like, what does this do? Nope, that's not it.
Well, it should be easier to crossfade, and it's not.
Oh, right? That took me like 3 hours one night to figure out.
I know. I tried so much, and I watched all the videos, and then finally I was like, you just have to help me. I can't. And it was. Once you know how to do it, it's like, oh, this is not intuitive at all, but okay, it's not that hard.
Exactly the same thing with me. After I figured it out, I was like, oh, like 3 buttons. That's not what the video told me to do.
Yeah.
where did you do Hydrogen Jukebox? Because Cindy's done it at 2 different theaters.
I did it at Chautauqua Opera this summer. So it was in August.
She did it in between both of mine. So when she was at TCO doing Hansel and Gretel with Danielle and I was already in prep for my Hydrogen Jukebox. And Kara kept being like, no, don't talk about it. Don't say anything about it, because I'm trying to prep my own and I don't want to get your ideas in my head.
Yeah, I don't want to steal. Like, I'm so worried about inadvertently stealing any ideas from people. So I try to avoid any sort of discussion. Although Allison and I did compare research, and she gave me just the most amazing comprehensive list of books. So that was great.
That's good. Book research.
Sharing knowledge.
A lot of books.
Yes. I think I had like 17 books that I brought to her. Yeah.
It's way too many.
Well, it also, T, who she just mentioned, who helped design the projections, he had just done it somewhere in New Orleans, Louisiana, something. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, everybody, so we weren't allowed to talk at TCO because everybody had too many ideas. It was very entertaining. And I wanted to go see it. I wanted to go see it in Chautauqua, but that was a weekend that Danielle and T decided to get married, and so I couldn't go up to Chautauqua and see it. Very bad planning on their part.
I hope I get to direct it again someday. I can see like 5 other different productions of it. It's such a great show.
It is, and there's no like, it's not like Bohème, you know, where it's kind of like cut and dry, you know? You can do so many different things with it, so it's really amazing.
Yeah, the two that you did that I think I worked on the first one, and then we went and saw the second one, completely different.
Completely. And hers, from what I talk about in some of the projection you do, it's just completely different from either of the two that I did, which is kind of what I love about I love about Philip Glass, but also I feel about a lot of newer operas is that it's, you have that like ability to play and things aren't already set in their ways. You know, when you do a traditional piece, so many people expect you to do it traditionally because that's how they've always seen it. And you don't have that to fight against when you have a new piece. So I think that's why I like new pieces so much. It's just,
yeah, I think so. There's a lot of room. Like Afterlife, you know, in the opera, there's a stage direction that says it's an unknowable place. And it could be anything. It's like, what is that? And I actually designed the set and I was inspired by like icebergs. Like one of the Afterlife was like being stuck on an iceberg, so it's like these crazy stairs and ramps and it's nuts. But someone else could read that and just do something completely different, and
right, like a barren desert, or you know
it could be anything. What an unknowable place could be anything, and it's fun.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. So what this is a bit off topic, but something I've kind of been interested in as we've been talking to people, and it's such a big thing in today's world. Well, I mean, I guess it should always be, but how is it being a female director? Has it been a challenge for you work in the opera world, especially as a director?
Well,
kind of an advantage.
Okay, wait, we can't hear any of that. You cut in and out all the time. So I'm going to repeat it.
Okay, good. Cause I don't know what's going on.
I don't know. But I'm like, Kai, can you even edit this? And he's like, I can't do anything with that. Okay. So how is it working in a field that I don't know if directing is more female or male dominated? Definitely in my field, in technical directing, it's mostly male, as most crews are. I've worked with a number of male and female stage managers, but how do you find it being a female in this world? Do you think you have any advantages, disadvantages? Do you even notice any difference being a female in this industry?
I think it's an interesting time. You know, Cindy, we actually met at the Women in Opera session. So
that's what it was.
Is the fact that there's an awareness that there's a disparity, because the numbers are so terrible in terms of, and not just directors, but designers and general directors. And it's similar to the film industry. I mean, I'm sure the numbers of directors is close to, like, I mean, definitely less than 10% of operas going up. I feel like I've been really lucky that I've been continuing to work. And I feel like I've had quite a fast starting late and in going into professional directing. I feel like I've been very lucky and fortunate to keep getting hired and keep getting more shows, but I'm still only directing at the lowest budget companies and assisting at the larger budget companies, where I really see the effect is the level one and level two companies. I still don't see, other than Francesca Zambello, who's running the company, and she employs female directors and directors of diverse backgrounds. I don't see a lot of change. I don't see women doing much in terms of world premieres. Like, if you see a world premiere in San Francisco, I've never seen it be a female director. I don't see any female directors at the Met. So, you know, I think that the change is going to come when it comes from there being more general directors who are women. You know, if you look at Francesca's seasons at Glimmer Glass and at WNO, she has female conductors, she has female directors, she has, African-American directors. She has a diversity in terms of who she's hiring. And I don't see that at a lot of the larger budget companies yet. And I see the women who are directing at BLO and those companies getting the rented set productions as opposed to the new productions. And I wonder why that is. And I hope that it will begin to shift more. And I hope that all of the attention that Opera America is starting to put on the disparity will lead to at least some of these general directors having a sense of, okay, I need to look at who is on my season in terms of the artistic roster. But I don't know. It's tough. And I've certainly heard people say, like, I've certainly experienced this in my life where I feel like I have to show people what I can do and then they will hire me, as opposed to, like, I feel like I have some of colleagues who are men who are directors who people talk about their potential and their genius and want to give them a chance. But I don't know whether that's because of sort of the thing that's been researched, which is people like to bring up people who remind them of themselves. And unless they consciously choose to look outside they're, and since there's just a lot of white men in charge of opera companies, they will continue to bring up directors who are that. So I don't know. It's complicated. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I've noticed, I mean, almost, let's see, the first female director I worked with was Keturah back in 2014-13, and then nobody else until, you know, last season, where it was with, or two seasons ago, you, and then
Allison,
thank you. I was like, I can see her. Allison. And so I have seen it a little bit more. When I was just at Boston, the lady, there was a female who directed the Tosca, which was right before Burke and Hare. Actually, there's another one when I, Robin, who directed War Stories at Philadelphia. So there's a female. You know, so I have seen it more in the last couple of years than I have in years previous. I think the trend is there's more female stage managers everywhere. Kind of like what you were saying, like level one companies, you know, you don't get females. Broadway's kind of the same way, you know, it's a male-dominated world. In the last few years, I have seen designers and more female like technical directors. I know at least three, my sister and two others who are technical directors. Whereas when I was first in school, like that really just wasn't, we didn't even really discuss it. Like it wasn't a thing because it didn't really exist. So I do think it's changing, but I think it's still going to be like 20 more years before, you know, the people who are now starting to see some women are old enough to take those positions.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've worked with a female director in years. Kimberly Wood, she directs some of the shows at the conservatory at Palos Verdes. But besides that, most all of our professional shows, we haven't had a female director. They've all been males. Half of our stage managers have been male, half female, so we're pretty good with that. Most of my crew is male. I usually have one or two females, but I'd say it's more male heavy. But that's also just who comes to, you know,
who replies.
Yeah, replies to my information. And I do have to admit, I am biased in the way that I judge a lot of when people walk in the room. I know it's probably bad, but if you're coming in for a tech position and you're wearing a skirt and you have your nails done and you have makeup on and you have a bunch of jewelry, and then I see a guy walk in and he's dressed nice, but his hands aren't perfectly clean and he's got jeans on and something, then I'm like, is that girl really going to want to climb in the catwalks and wrap up dirty cables? Like, she spent how much money on those nails? Like, and not that they can't do it. I've hired a couple of girls who are great at it. It's just, I don't know. It's kind of like, well, I assume the boys are more likely to get dirty. But then again, I hired one guy who always wore slacks and a button-up t-shirt. And I was like, we're unloading a truck today. So are you going to wear that? So I don't know if that makes a difference.
Did he?
Either. He did. And he still wears it today. And he's been touring all over the world with rock and roll groups and Blink-182 and all doing lights for him. It just, that's just what he wears. Slacks and a button-up t-shirt.
I mean, I think also it's similar, and you know, you see it play out in the film world, what a big deal it was to have Patty Jenkins direct Wonder Woman, and you know, Ava DuVernay is going to do Wrinkle in Time. And it's just for so long, when you, if you Google director, like stage director or film director, men's faces show up. So I mean, I definitely think, you know, I was a film major, and I feel like I self-selected myself out. My classes were 96% men. It was really hard to get a word in edgewise. And I just felt like I didn't know how to assert myself in an aggressive way. And I think, you know, I do think there's still this sense of, can this woman have a crew? Can they lead a team? And I think it's just people aren't used to seeing it. And that alone is enough to cause the reluctance. But yeah, I mean, I've only assisted Katora and Kathleen Belcher, the only female directors that I've gotten to assist. It's always men. I do think, just like film, I think it's important, like, that women and directors who are not white get to direct more in opera, because it's just a different voice. I mean, if you're a woman directing Carmen, you're going to have a different way into it than a man directing Carmen. There's so many of the operas that are naturally misogynist. And if you actually fight against the misogyny to do something that's more human and more dimensional, the opera's going to be better. And not saying that a man couldn't also do that. But I do think, you know, people, the best directors bring themselves to the work. And if you have different voices, you're going to have more variety of work and interesting work.
This is so... It's such a similar conversation that I had with Allison one night, because she said when she first started out in theater that she didn't realize that she could become a director because she didn't see any female directors. Mm-hmm. So to her, it's very important that people see female directors. But secondly, that's why I asked, do you think it's an advantage to be a female? Because we had a whole discussion about Boheme, and it's my least favorite, one of my least favorite shows. And she was like, how can you say that Boheme's so wonderful? And I was like, I've done it twice. I've seen it twice. I just, I don't like it. You know, to me, it's boring. It's, I don't understand the characters. There's no development. There's no relationship, blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, who's directed it? And I was telling her the names. And she said, well, you've never seen it with a female director. And I was like, no, I haven't. So she was telling me how she interprets it. And if she ever had a chance to do Bohème, how she add anything to Bohème, all the music's there. So it's not like you're adding scenes, but the way that she would come at it, it was so different than any way that I've ever done it or seen it. That I was like, I might actually like your Bohème. It might be the first Bohème, you know, that I would be interested in. So I totally agree with what you say about Carmen. If you know, you only have a male directing Carmen or even Cozy or, you know, almost all of those operas, it would be completely different with a female voice and a female perspective, because, you know, they are sometimes very strong female roles, but a guy just will come at it completely different. So
I agree.
I think we totally need more females, but I think that, well, I hope that this is something that in 20 years, as horrible as that is to say so far away, you know, but if young women start seeing us in these roles now, that in 20 years, you know, when they're much older and they're in the professional field, that it'll be a much larger pool of women and a much larger pool of non-white men in the field. Yeah. So
I definitely have sensed at least a little shift. I feel like my first Opera America conference I went to was in 2010. And, you know, I sat in on a lot of sessions and it felt like a real boys club. And as the years have gone by, you know, I haven't gone to every conference, but it has felt a bit more inclusive and, not so much like I'm on the outside, which is great. But I do feel like it has to come from a conscious, like in the same way that there's been grants for female composers, which has led to more commissioning of female composers. I feel like mm-hmm. that general directors who are in a position to maybe look at their season and say, oh, wow, all my conductors and all my directors and all my designers are men. Maybe that's a problem. Maybe I should look outside my normal hiring pool and take a chance on someone, because there's certainly an amazing pool of talent. I mean, you mentioned Robin Guarino, who's been directing forever. I was so thrilled to see her have such a high profile directing job at Philly, but she's been in the game. You know, I feel like she hasn't gotten enough work. And I'm glad that she is starting to get more higher profile directing jobs.
He says, yeah. Well, and is she head of opera now at CCM, I think? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that, again, is wonderful, because when I was there, I believe, well, I think it was Sandra. But, you know, just the fact that she is the head of the program at CCM, which is a very top rated school, and she's a female, I think will help push the envelope a little bit. And even over in TDNP, where I was, you know, she's Michelle Kay is a female, so we're now strong women in these positions at universities, which I think will help women see, you know, can make a living doing this, and they don't have to be men. But
yes, please.
I tried to for the little bit that I have up in Palos Verdes, a couple of times people have written me or talked to somebody in the company who's like, hey, we have a Girl Scout troop who wants to come get a tour of the theater. We have a elementary group that wants to get a tour of the theater. What do you think? And I'm like, yes, absolutely. Bring them in and I'll talk to them and I'll show them around. And when they ask me what I do, I say, I manage all these boys. Mm-hmm. I'm in charge of these boys and I know what they do and I make sure they do it right. But females can't do this. And it was just... I never really thought about it too much before I talked to this Girl Scout troop, and I looked around and I had five guys on stage and they were all guys working, and mm-hmm. they're like, well, what do you do? And I'm like, I make sure they do their job.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. It's like, yep, that's right.
The whole, like, if you can see it, you can be it thing. I think it's really important. Like, this is so nerdy, but, you know, with Wonder Woman, they had the behind the scenes and they had like a group of high school film students who were all girls come on set and watch Patty Jenkins direct. And it's like, oh my God, if I had that when I was a kid, like when I was a film major, there was Martin Scorsese and, you know, like there's all these auteurs and Steven Spielberg and all these, they were all men. Like, I didn't
right.
know any female director. We didn't study any female directors. It was like, how could I be the one? And I feel
right.
like that, like, young women can see, like, women in power doing things. It's like, oh, yeah, I could do that. Like, I mean, as sad as I was that the election went the way it did, at least, like, little girls saw a woman run for president, and maybe, like, soon, you know, at least they can have a thought in their mind, well, maybe I could do that.
Yeah,
you
it's know? Not right. just if you're a woman, you can be the wife of a president. It's like, no, you can still be the president. You can be the secretary of state. You can be all kinds of things. You don't just have to be the wife of a male who's doing something.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure I was taught in school that you had to be a man to be president. Like, I was, I don't know if the teacher was wrong, but it was like, you have to be 35 years old, you have to be a citizen, you have to be a man. And I think about that now, and I was like, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, and that's not true.
I actually remember, and Stacey, I don't know if you remember this, it probably sticks out in my head more, whatever year it is that you're like, learn about presidents or whatever, you know, sometime elementary school. And I remember the teacher saying, do any of you ever want to be president? And I remember raising my hand, and I think I was like the only one. And this might just be my memory, but I remember her looking at me and being like, well, you're a female. And I was still young enough at the time that I was like, I don't understand what that has to do with anything. Like, why can I not be president? You know? But it was totally something that was put in my head, like, well, you can't do it because you're female.
Yeah.
And, you know, thankfully, Stacey and I were raised strong enough, you know, that we were always told you could do whatever you wanted. And I was like, I don't understand why you would even say something like that to me, you know.
You could still do it, please.
No, we don't need to deal with that kind of bullshit, twin. Shit they can pull up on our family.
Well, true. I think I'll stick with trying to run some big opera companies first, maybe getting into some level 2 opera companies first. I'll set my sights high on opera for you, Kara. We'll get into some level 1 and 2 companies and we'll show them how it's done. It's so much fun. Those are like my 3 big questions for you that I wanted to chat about. Stacey, did you have anything?
Well, we kind of talked about, one of my things was like, what if you could do any piece, opera, musical, straight play, anything, what's like the one thing you really want to direct?
Oh my God, there's so many, but just off the top of my head, I definitely want to direct Little Night Music. I love that show. Also West Side Story. I guess I love musicals, but in terms of opera, I want to direct David T. Little and Royce Babreck's JFK because it premiered 2 years ago, and it's like, it's just the most beautiful thing ever. And I want to do a world premiere. Like, I want to be able to work with like composers in the room. Like, I was lucky enough to assist on As One, which is everywhere now, and being there with Laura Kaminsky and Mark Campbell and Kim Reed and their rehearsal every day. It's just a different type of a process. I also got to assist on The Long Walk. And, you know, it's just, it's so exciting to be there with people. And, you know, like when we were doing Long Walk, Jeremy and Stephanie, they agreed to cut a scene. There was changes, you know, it's very alive. So I think that I want to tell new stories and stories that are really relevant. I would like to direct Carmen and I guess Bohème. I have a very storied past with Bohème because it was like this opera that I was supposed to sing and then I got kicked out and trauma. So I feel like it would be good to direct it.
It'd be like coming first full circle and
yes.
Yeah, closing that gap that was there. I love what you said about new pieces because I've always, and for 10 years, I've loved new pieces and I've done like West Coast premieres and all these like West Coast California things. But to do Burke and Hare last month was such a dream because, you know, we had Mark Campbell and Julian Grant in the room and, you know, the very first time the orchestra played it on our first orchestra read and Julian and Mark were there and Julian just started crying, you know, because it was the first time that he'd actually heard this piece with a full on orchestra. And when we did our room run, you know, it was the first time that Mark and Julian got to see this piece that they'd been working on in years with, you know, full on run. And they worked with David for a while to help create the piece. I mean, David worked with him as the director, even as far as all the stage directions and stuff in the libretto. And they came, well, Julian came to every performance. I think Mark was there for most of them. And it was just, you said the whole room's kind of alive to sit there with these people, and, you know, to have Maestro turn around in the middle of an orchestra rehearsal and be like, does this note really make sense? Or did you miss a marking, or did you forget where the cello comes in, or whatever? And to have them there in the room with you, it's something that you don't experience when you're working on a Mozart or Puccini. You just assume that this is, you know, it is what it is, and you can't really ask the questions to the people who created the piece. So it's so much fun.
When Tom Tupulo came to watch the run through like a rehearsal of Glory Denied, it was the first time ever having like directing a living composer's opera, and it's so much pressure, but it's the best, because, like, you know, he was so nice, and also he was like, wow, you did things that I never thought of, and it totally works. And to have that kind of feedback from him, it's just an entirely different feeling, because there, and also, you know, some of the family is still alive, who's the story is about. And, like, you know, it's a different level of responsibility, and the stakes are higher.
Right.
And I don't know, people always ask about, like, what's the difference between directing contemporary opera and a standard. And I feel like, if it was written in the last 20 years, there's an immediacy to the material that you don't have to, like, find a take on. You don't have to find a take, because it's all there. And it's just about being, like, as true you can to the piece and making it come to life in the most clear and effective way possible. Whereas if I'm going to do a Bohème, it's like, well, what do I have to say about Bohème? And then it's like a whole extra layer, which is fine. But, like, I love the immediacy of the stories that people are choosing to tell. With the operas they're creating right now.
Mm-hmm. And I love that there's so many new operas. And I think this is partly, mostly due to Opera America and their new works grants.
I think also the thing that's great about how much new opera is happening, someone wrote a blog post about the Ricky and Gordon's new musical, what is it, The House Without a Christmas Tree? And just how intimate acting was, and how it's very much, you know, really naturalistic acting. And I feel like with both HD at the Met and the amount of contemporary opera, the demands in terms of what you can expect as a director for acting it's higher. And I love that. I love that people are interested in finding the truth for themselves. And really, I feel like it's not just like a blocking and standing. It's a collaboration with the singers on finding the truthfulness of the moment. And more singers are game for that. And just that they love it. And I think it comes from some of the demands of contemporary opera. I mean, you can't just fake it. You can't fake it. It's intimate. It's real. And, you know, I think see right through you.
So many newer operas, and not all of them, because there's definitely stuff like JFK, which is huge, but they're being written for more of a chamber style feel. Mm-hmm. And not a big 2,000 seat proscenium house. And so it is a much smaller ensemble where they're kind of writing knowing that the audience is going to be 5 feet away from them.
Yeah.
So I think they're being written to highlight that, which I also think is amazing, because for me, at least, you can only watch Park and Bark so many times before you actually want to see some interaction on stage.
Yeah, it's very true. Yeah. I remember I watched, I've seen two of Wagner's operas of the Ring Cycle, and both times I want the big dragon, I want this and that. And one time at LA Opera a couple years ago, I forget which Ring Cycle I was watching, and they physically stood behind cutouts of characters and stood there and sang. And after 4 hours, I was like, okay, now what? Where's the dragon or something cool?
Yeah, I mean, I people sometimes ask me, it's like, what do you offer as a director? And I feel like for me, if I go see an opera at the Met and I feel absolutely nothing for 3 hours, like something's wrong. Like there's this music that's so beautiful. It should be moving. You should feel something. It doesn't have to be like, you should have feelings. So if I'm directing something and I'm bored, then I'm failing. So I have to like make something that moves people in a way. And maybe it's confusing them or making them think about something or making them cry. But it has to have some sort of reach out to pull people in. Otherwise it's like, what's the point?
I don't know. Like I could just listen to the Ring Cycle on, you know, in my car as I'm driving somewhere. I don't need to sit here in this opera house to do it. Like, give me something else, something for me to look at, something for me to imagine besides my own imagination.
Yeah, I think it's, I would love to do some point a panel with other directors on like acting in opera and how they go about, like, I work with young singers a lot. So a lot of times they don't have a lot of training, they don't have a lot of experience, and their voices have been training for 10 years, but they don't have moment to moment, like normal Uta Hagen, Stanislavski based acting training, and they have no tools. And so, like, I found when I was a singer, like, because I trained so long as an actor and then came to singing late, there were certainly things that worked. And then there was ones that, like, okay, I can't do this and count and watch a conductor. Like, I cannot be a method actor, but I can use like objective based acting. And like, what is that? And trying to really create a toolbox for actors, for acting singers, of what can be effective and active. So they're not standing there. Like, I feel like with so many operas that have all these arias that, like, things are terrible, and like there's
everybody's crying, it's so upsetting,
like, we don't want to watch you fall apart, we want to watch you like rise to the circumstance and like climb from the depths of despair, and there has to be like an active element to the acting. And so I feel like that's a lot of times the biggest job is like, don't play an emotion, don't play the victim, like, what are you doing, what do you want? We have to find that. And then pursue it with all that you have, because that's exciting.
Yeah, and for them to play and for the rest of us to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm going to keep cutting out, so I was just not talking.
Now you're perfectly clear.
I know, now that it I'm not saying anything.
Don't say anything important. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, we're just going to cut it out anyways because we can't hear you.
No. I don't, yeah, maybe by the time we do our next interview, I'll have my new computer up and running, and that Skype will work better. I don't know.
You've had your new computer for like a week and a half. What have you been doing?
I don't have an adapter for, because Kai insists I use a headset.
Well, you did sound stupid when you weren't using a headset, so yeah.
See? So I'm using my old computer. That's what's going on.
Give us what you need, and we'll just send you an adapter on Amazon.
Okay, great. I'll send you a picture of what it is.
Great. Kai will fix it, and then we'll be better.
Okay, good.
I think we have an interview on Saturday, so you better get going on that.
Okay.
I'll work on that. Did you get a new Mac?
No, I got a new, I think it's a Dell.
Oh, a you Dell said computer. It was a Dell.
Yeah.
I had to get a new MacBook for projections.
We can't handle, I don't think she could do a Mac. She hasn't been trained on it, and she can barely do a PC.
Yeah, this is true. I actually had to use a Mac in Boston because the Wi-Fi in our rehearsal studios only worked on Macs.
That's weird.
It was really annoying. And so me and one ASM had PCs, and the PA, AD, and the other ASM all had Macs. And I was like, I can't function if I can't do emails or send another report. So the director of production gave me her old MacBook. So then for like 3 weeks, I had to figure out how to use a Mac and like transfer all my documents over to it and stuff. And then when I went back to my PC, it was really difficult because I was like, why is this, you know, the right click and the double click and all these things are different. But now I'm much more of a PC person. So,
yeah, internet's important. I keep ending up in housing with internet. That's like, people, if you want me to respond to your emails and attach documents, I need internet.
So when Kara was at TCO, she didn't have internet worth her housing. And I was like, you need to write this in your contract. I try to write it in all of my stage manager's contracts. And she was like, yeah, this is ridiculous. We're not doing this again. And then like a couple months later, she sends me a text message. She was like, guess what I don't have at this house?
Why is internet just not everywhere? I don't understand. It should be a universal utility now.
Yeah, I know. But like so many companies, like where I stay in New Orleans, it's like a donated apartment that someone is like, it's like their pied-à-terre. And so they don't put internet in it. And people don't want to cover it. Like, they don't feel like it's essential, but it's crazy. Like I use it every day for my job.
Oh, not even every day. It's like every 10 minutes, somebody's texting me or emailing me.
Well, now I have a manager who I've negotiated all my contracts up until May, and now she takes over after that. So I told her, like, there must be internet. There has to be heat. heat's important. A fridge I can actually put stuff in. Maybe a kitchen. Yeah. I have a list.
Minor details.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to be like a pain, but you know, people are always like, well, it's only for a month. And it's like, yeah, and then I have another month, and then it's another. It's like my whole life's on the road. So if every housing is terrible, then my life is terrible.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
That sucks. Yeah, I don't think I could do what I couldn't. Like, I lasted 4 days in Boston without internet. And at the time, I actually got paid for quite a bit of overtime because rehearsal would end. I'd have to pack up all my stuff, walk a mile to the office, sit there and send out my report and the schedule and answer the emails that came in the last 7 hours and sit at the office until midnight. So I was claiming all this overtime because I was like, if I don't have working internet in the rehearsal room, I don't have anything else, you know?
Yeah.
I have no other option. So after 3 days of overtime, they got me a MacBook so that I could function.
Smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are you going to do? Okay. So our last question is, do you have any twin stories?
Gosh, I so don't have any good ones. I mean, okay, Lindsay working is a twin.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I've certainly worked with Lindsay, but Lauren does not work in theater, and I only have gotten to see Lauren at fun social events. But they're good twins. And then let's see.
I'm glad they're good twins and not bad twins.
I feel like if I had to, like, the twins that are most prominent in my life over the last couple of years are the Property Brothers. Like, as silly as
watch a bit of that.
That's like my twin interaction. I still can't tell them apart. Like Drew and Jonathan, they really look alike.
I don't know.
You guys not watch that show?
I've seen like one or two episodes.
Shit, but...
Oh yeah, they're pretty good. They're very entertaining. I mean, they have like 5 different shows. They have an empire. I blame them completely for us buying a Fixer Upper. Because they made it seem like such a good idea. It's like, oh, you just buy a fixer-upper and then you fix it up. But the thing that they leave out is that they don't tell you that, like, you have to finance the renovation. And really, when you get a mortgage, you should add, like, $100,000 for renovation. But no one tells you that. So you get a mortgage and then you're like, oh, God, well, how am I going to come up with this cash? I have no idea. So, yeah.
They lied to you through TV. How that dare they?
Are liars.
Man, if they told you all their secrets, they wouldn't be so rich.
It's true. And now they have a partnership with Chase Bank, so I wonder if it's like a buy and renovation loan.
Interesting.
That would actually be a pretty awesome loan. I would totally do that.
Yeah, Wells Fargo has it. No one told us this, but I wish someone had told us, but Wells Fargo has one. You can, like, if you get a contractor, if you want to buy a house and it's like a total rundown thing, then you get a contractor to come in and give like a written bid, and then you can add that amount to your mortgage.
That's
just like
awesome.
Cash out at closing. Yeah. These are things you learn.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I wish I had more twins. I guess when I grew up going to horseback riding camp, there's Margaret and Harriet. They were very different twins. Like, one was like very outgoing, the other was very not outgoing. And yet they looked so much alike, but then they changed their hair so everybody could tell them apart.
No, Stacey and I don't do that. We usually have pretty similar hair. So yeah.
Sometimes yours is a little more red than mine. Mine has sometimes more blonde highlights due to the Californianness, though they're paid for. It's definitely not due to my exposure to the sun for long hours.
I would say, you never see the sun, right?
Nope.
That's true.
And then you have glasses and I don't, so that's how a lot of people tell.
Yeah,
that's true. Very true. Well, thanks, Cara, for joining us on our podcast and for chatting with us about all this exciting stuff. Hopefully in a few years, we'll see more females out here and we could talk about how it's progressing or get Opera America to do something with us. And
I hope so. We could do some panels.
I'm working on some panels. Yeah. With USITT and Opera America and stuff. We can like throw out t-shirts with our logos on them. I've been to enough Comic Cons. I know how to play these games.
People love t-shirts. I used to take tennis classes, and if you like hit the t-shirt, then you won it. So that was how they taught us tennis. They'd like put t-shirts on.
Free t-shirts. I wear them all the time. It's like, what's that one? I don't know. It's a free t-shirt.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Okay.
Right, well, thank you both and have a great night.
Thanks. You.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Twins Talk Theater. If you would like more, visit our website at twinstalktheater.podbean.com or on Facebook at Twins Talk Theater. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Google Play Music. Also, give us a review on iTunes and tell us what you like about the show.